Possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen. In November 1998, the journal Science published a report on the development of the first line of human embryonic stem cells. The news set off a storm of excitement by some about the medical possibilities and alarm by others about the ethical implications. It also probably set off a wave of confusion by many of us about what the heck is a stem cell and why are some people so excited or alarmed. On Focus 580, we regard confusion simply as an invitation for us to roll up our sleeves. So during this hour, we'll try to clear up some of the key points about the science and ethics of stem cells and their implications for human health. Our guest is someone who pretty much does that for a living. Christopher Thomas Scott is a Stanford University lecturer in human biology and directs the Stanford program in stem cells and society. He is a committee member of the International Society of Stem Cell Research and was a founder and executive editor of the award-winning biotech journal Acumen. He is also the author of a book we'll draw from today entitled Stem Cell Now, From the Experiment That Shook the World to the New Politics of Life, the book recently published by PI Press. That's PI Press. In the book, Christopher Scott explains the science behind the stem cell revolution and the arguments for and against the use of embryonic stem cells. And we'll talk about that during this hour. As we talk with Christopher Thomas Scott, we will invite you into the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. And Dr. Scott joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon.
Yes, and by the way, the book I should mention for folks is extremely readable in terms of the language, not a lot of deep scientific language, but very accessible, I think.
Well, thank you very much. That's always good to hear.
Yeah. Well, let me start this way. This is probably a typical first question in just about any interview you do, but it's also probably the best place to begin. What are stem cells?
Well, there are two varieties of stem cells. One is the controversial variety that you hear a lot about in the press. Those are the so-called embryonic stem cells. And then there's another variety of stem cells called adult stem cells. And the difference between the two are pretty much in their developmental age. So embryonic stem cells are the first stem cells that appeared during the animal's development very, very early on. They appear in the embryo, actually. That's why they have that name. Mm-hmm. And then those cells actually go on to become all of the cell types in the body. In the human, we think they're between 200 and 250 different kinds of cells in the body, and among those cells are the adult stem cells. An interesting point about adult stem cells is that they're called adult stem cells because we have them all the way up until we die, but they actually appear during fetal development while we're still in the womb.
Well, let's talk about the mechanics of how that happens then. The embryonic stem cells are essentially the starting point for an orchestrated set of transformations and growth.
They are. They're the ancestors of any organism, really. They've been an object of intense study for 30 or 40 years, and most recently, of course, as you mentioned in the opening, intense study for human biology and human medicine for about the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm. And how did we come to your book essentially tells the story of how we came to understand their role in human development.
Right. It's a series of very interesting stories about the discovery of embryonic stem cells and stem cells in general. And if you trace it back far enough, you can actually go back into the 1950s when scientists were looking at how animals of other kinds developed, the frogs, amphibians, and then moving into the more higher order animals such as mice and sheep, and then finally into the primates, monkeys, and then finally into man. So the interesting thing about stem cells is that from a biological history perspective, they've been around for a while, and at least their properties have been well documented in other animals. The most recent research really is now focusing on how to use embryonic stem cells for a number of very interesting questions, both in science and then, of course, in medicine, too. Their therapeutic promise, both types of cells, is quite astounding.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could sort of describe how it is, what we know about the process of how a stem cell starts. It starts as one type of you know, root cell, as you said, the ancestor to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, over the course of development, the body essentially specializes. The cells produce very specialized cells.
Yes.
In a very sort of sophisticated, elaborate way.
Right. So the way that stem cells change is, of course, orchestrated through our genes, and it's by a cascade of genes that are turning on and off during development that instructs stem cells to either make more of themselves or to change into more mature types. And it's quite a spectacular process, really a process that we know very little about. But the idea is that as the organism develops and grows older, genes are turning on and off, and these cells then become cells that go to different places in the developing body. Some cells might become brain cells. Other cells may be the cells that actually make the skull in which the brain goes. And then, of course, the connections need to be made between the cells. So it's quite fantastic to think about how these cells kind of go hither and yon through development and actually make a complete organism. The stunning thing about animal development in general, but even human development in particular, is that we all begin as one cell, the fertilized egg. And when we're born, we are billions or even trillions of cells. And, you know, a complete human organism is up to 50 or 60 trillion cells. So it's quite an amazing procedure to go from one to many, many trillions of cells.
So those trillions of specialized cells all stem from the original stem cells, hence the name. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So as the cells basically they duplicate themselves, or there are alterations of the structure of the cells that they produce. You mentioned the adult stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
How do those come about, and what is their function?
Well, adult stem cells are found in various nooks and crannies of the body, and their purpose really is to keep us going. So if you look at a person on the street, even yourself, your cells are dying at prodigious rates. So, for example, our skin cells are falling off, literally falling off our body at a million cells or so per minute. Our blood cells die in the billions every day. They're simply just used up in the process of living. So we needed to evolve a system of replacing those cells, and stem cells of a couple of varieties that I just mentioned, blood in particular, serve to replenish cells that die of old age. They also exist to help us recover from disease and injury. So, for example, if you have an accident and hurt your liver, and let's say you lose part of your liver, there are stem cells in that organ that will actually grow a new liver in as little as a few weeks. Those are very powerful types of stem cells. And then we're uncovering different kinds of adult stem cells, it seems like, every couple of months. And those stem cells, some of them are very powerful and can regenerate quickly, others not so much. And when I was in graduate school, I learned that, you know, once you had a neural stem cell or a nervous system stem cell or a nervous system cell that died, it simply wouldn't regrow.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're actually finding that we have neural stem cells, and that these cells actually can make new neurons. The difference is they don't make them as well or as quickly as the liver cell example I just told you about.
Mm-hmm. So these adult stem cells, the liver stem cells, the different types, they are essentially specialized to repair particular parts of the body.
Yeah, they're specialized for the tissue or the organ in which they hang out. So the blood stem cells, for example, their favorite place to kind of live and work are in the bone marrow and sometimes in the blood. We have stem cells in a deep layer of our skin. We have a very potent kind of stem cell in our intestines. And in fact, our intestines are one of those areas where we have a really high turnover. Our gut, for example, the lining of our intestines, actually turns over every 2 days. So we have a whole new group of cells that come in every 2 days. And of course, if you're going to lose cells that fast, you're going to need a really journeyman cell to replace those cells. And so we've got some pretty cool looking stem cells in our intestines too.
So the adult stem cells, and just to kind of put a fine point on it, you described this very well, they have become specialized to do a certain thing, but the embryonic stem cells have not developed any specialization whatsoever at that point.
That's right. In fact, scientists have come up with a few terms that kind of describe the power of the different kinds of stem cells, and without getting too much into detail, the embryonic stem cells are usually described as totipotent or totally potent. They're the most powerful variety. And then the adult stem cells have kind of differing degrees of potency. For example, the blood stem cell that I described can go on to become, I think, up to 9 different kinds of cells that we find in our blood, like the platelets and the red blood cells and the varying kinds of white blood cells. And those cells are usually called multipotent.
So there are different degrees of how cells are locked into one function. That there might be very specialized adult stem cells and more generalists?
Yes, that's a good way of describing it. Some adult stem cells have a number of different directions they can go. Other kinds of adult stem cells, not quite clear yet, but they may be more restricted in their potential. So they may be just headed down a road of which there's really not a lot of left or right. So it's just basically a straight ahead.
And the cells that all the stem cells produce, it's a one-way trip. They have been specialized, and they're not going back.
Well, that's an interesting question, and actually a question that's at the center of a lot of research and debate in the scientific community, and that's whether or not the adult stem cells can actually go backwards along their pathway and, say, de-evolve to something different. And there's some evidence in the laboratory that we can actually do this. It's one of those things that's called reprogramming, similar to kind of reprogramming your computer, wiping out all the data that causes a cell to become, let's say, a skin cell, and then moves it backwards along its developmental kind of timeline to an earlier version of itself. There's not a lot of evidence in the body that this is happening, but there is a fair degree of research that's going on to figure out if there is the capacity of the body to force cells to go backwards. If that's the case, it's really an interesting sort of trick, because if you could take an adult stem cell and somehow morph it into a different variety, then you could possibly use that different variety for a different purpose or a different disease or a different problem. A second sort of advantage of that sort of scenario is that the adult stem cells are less controversial to use than embryonic stem cells. If you just take an adult stem cell from your body, from a regular, you know, grown-up person, that's not as controversial as actually using a human embryo at the very earliest stage.
Right. And I'm sure we'll get into the ethical implications of all this. But I wanted to sort of lay the groundwork. One of the other words that is often used in discussing stem cells is the word cloning. And it quickly gets into, you know, people hear the word cloning and it raises, you know, various alarms and so forth. You make the distinction in your book that there is a very big difference between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning. And I wonder if you could talk about that and the role of stem cells in,
sure.
in that.
The two terms are lightning rods for the debate. They're also thrown around in Washington quite a bit by politicians and policymakers. And the point I make in Stem Cell Now about therapeutic cloning, let's start there first, mm-hmm. Is that the term therapeutic cloning isn't really very accurate. So the technique of therapeutic cloning actually came out of the animal cloning technology. So if you remember way back in, was it 96 or 97, Dolly the sheep mm-hmm. burst on the scene. And Dolly was made by taking an egg of one sheep and the nucleus, where the genetic material is, from another sheep, and putting that nucleus into that empty egg. The egg was stripped of its DNA. And that egg was then, over a few days, was in the laboratory, developed into a very early embryo, a sheep embryo, and that sheep embryo then was put into a third sheep, which was unrelated to the first two, if you're keeping track. Mm-hmm. And then after a few months, Dolly was born, and she was the genetic clone, as they say, of the donor nucleus, that nucleus that came from, it was actually the udder of the donor sheep, and hence the name Dolly, after the singer Dolly Parton.
Insider joke, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit of a science insider joke. There are not many science insider jokes that scientists can share, so that's one of them, I guess.
Okay.
So that technique, that is a reproductive cloning technique, and the fear is from some quarters of our society is that technique might be used to actually clone a human being. And I think that among scientists and ethicists and religious leaders, there is universal agreement that would be morally wrong. That would really account for the worst kind of human experimentation. I think the discussion centers on the rogue scientist or the rogue person in some country somewhere that might actually try to clone a human being. Mm-hmm. Cloning is, for animals, is an extremely inefficient process. Of the 20,000 or so attempts to clone animals, at least by one study I've read, only a few hundred animals actually survive because it's just a very, very rough procedure, and many clones actually die. Animal clones die in utero, and many of them, once they're born, are very, very unhealthy. So there's really good scientific and very good moral evidence and arguments for not cloning humans. However, if you take a part of this technique, and that's the technique I just described, by putting the genetic material from one cell into an egg whose nucleus has been removed, you can actually make a line of cells that are pretty close, a very close genetic match to the cell, the original cell. So the idea would be that if you had a person with disease or a person, say, with an injury, and you actually created a line of cells using the first part of this technique, called nuclear transfer, it's kind of a shorthand, you could actually come up with a line of cells that could be used to replace cells that are being killed off by, let's say, disease, or that have been lost by injury, or in a more kind of a more fantastic scenario, those that we lose during the aging process. And so on that last point, there's been quite a bit of press and interest about this whole field called regenerative medicine, the ability to kind of extend life beyond our normal lifespan using stem cells. And that, from my point of view, has been overhyped. That sort of scenario might actually happen, but I think it's many, many years out, and it will probably go very slowly.
But I want to carry on this line of inquiry, but I want to mention again our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580, is Christopher Thomas Scott. and he is head of the Stanford Program in Stem Cells and Society, also author of a book we're discussing, Stem Cell Now, From the Experiment That Shook the World to the New Politics of Life. If you would like to join our conversation, your questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. One of the you mentioned the idea of sort of replacing body tissue and things like that is something that it may be on the horizon, but quite a way away from where we are now. But there are other applications for using stem cells in research on the causes of disease.
Yes. In fact, there are a number of very interesting questions that can be probed using stem cells in the laboratory. Many of them active areas of research right now. For example, if you could find the cause of a developmental disease and observe how that disease actually manifests or starts in a plastic dish in the laboratory, that might give some very interesting clues to how you might attack the disease with, let's say, a certain type of therapy, such as gene therapy or a new kind of drug. So I think the near-term sort of results from stem cell research, both embryonic, by the way, and adult, would be these kinds of model systems, these kind of laboratory systems that can help us understand a little bit more about human biology and how we become what we are and how kind of developmental wrong turns lead to certain diseases. There are also some pretty interesting things to learn about in the medical application, too. And so not all of stem cells is just basic research or in the laboratory. Some of the stem cell discoveries have now reached the clinic and are being tested in humans. A type of stem cell therapy has been a part of the bone marrow transplantation field for a few years now, and it's working with some pretty interesting results. And then and your listeners probably have heard about cord blood or umbilical cord blood. Mm-hmm. And cord blood is a rich source of stem cells. There aren't very many in there, but those cells that are in a baby's umbilical cord, the stem cells, are quite powerful. They're of the blood-forming variety, and there's some evidence that these cells actually can make different kinds of cells other than blood. So if that's the case, the cord blood actually might represent one of the first big clinical successes using stem cells. And right now, cord blood is used to cure children with some forms of cancers and anemias.
And there are several companies offering services associated with saving or storing the umbilical cord stem cells.
Yes, there are dozens, maybe even more than 20 companies, and it's actually quite confusing to parents who are considering donating or storing their baby's blood on which to use. There are public cord blood banks, there are private nonprofit cord blood banks, and then there are the commercial variety too. And for parents who have a child already born, that is, that has a genetic disease or a type of cancer that could be actually treated with cord blood from a healthy sibling, the decisions are pretty straightforward. You definitely want to save that cord blood and use it, if you can, for that therapy. For parents who have otherwise healthy children and are kind of faced with this decision in the hospital, it's a little tougher call. Stem cell therapies right now are very, very early in their development, and it's not clear whether cord blood will really achieve the promise that a lot of companies advertise on their website. So I think the best advice for parents that I can give is to go slowly and to do a lot of research and to talk to doctors, clinicians, especially stem cell and bone marrow types of doctors, about the state of the art and what one company might have or one bank might have over another advantages and that sort of thing.
One of the things as we read about the controversy about stem cells, that there are an existing number of stem cell lines. And back in August 2001, President Bush announced he would forbid federal funding for creating new stem cell lines or any research being done on them. Just to sort of start on this, could you talk about what are stem cell lines? Where do they come from?
Right. Well, first off, the Bush proclamation in 2001 said that no federal funding would be allowed to create, would be used to create new embryonic stem cell lines. So the National Institutes of Health, the big funding agency, $28.8 billion, I think, this year, mm-hmm. which funds research, biomedical research of all kinds, can fund embryonic stem cell research for those lines on the Bush registry, what they call the registry of stem cells, that were made prior to 2001. And then a point of clarification on embryonic stem cell research in the United States, it can actually, you can do that research. It's permitted in actually all states but one. South Dakota recently enacted a bill that makes it illegal. But that research can only be done, at least now, with private funds.
Oh, okay.
So that's the first point. So the question, what's an embryonic stem cell line? Well, it begins with a human embryo at day four, and that embryo is a ball of cells, about 40 or 50 cells in total. And it is a very, very small. You can't see it really with your naked eye. You have to look at it with a microscope. And if you did peer at it under a microscope, you'd notice inside it's hollow. And inside this hollow cavity, kind of nestled against one side, is a mound of about 40 or 50 cells. And scientists have a term for it. They call it the inner cell mass. Mm-hmm. And if you take those cells, those 40 or 50 cells, and you take them out and you put them into a plastic dish, under the right conditions, those cells will multiply. And they will multiply and divide, and you get more and more of them, and then once they kind of overgrow the laboratory dish, you split them in two, just like kind of a sourdough batter, I guess you might imagine, and put them into two other dishes, and they will grow indefinitely. And the first lines that were made 10 years ago are still going strong. And when someone says, I have an embryonic stem cell line, that's what they mean. They have a line of cells that came from an embryo. The embryo was most likely donated through an IVF or in vitro fertilization clinic where the parents had undergone the procedure, had a birth, or decided not to use the extra embryos that were made during that procedure and donate them to science. And the Bush administration has a registry of allowable lines that scientists can work on. Initially, they thought they had almost 80 lines, and it turns out that the number of lines that scientists in the United States can actually work on with government funds now are less than 20. I've seen reports anywhere from 12 to 20. So it's really a very, very thin resource for a lot of reasons. First, the lines were made with old technology. They're not that great for current modern uses of science. They have a very limited genetic range. They came mostly from white middle-class couples that had, you know, reproductive problems. And so in terms of really needing more embryonic stem cell lines to do the right kind of research, both for developmental problems and for important scientific questions, and for the therapies we hope to have come from them, we really need hundreds or even thousands of these lines from a variety of sources. And that's really the debate, I think, at this point in many circles, is how do we get past this this problem of using embryos, and how can we create embryonic stem cell lines that can really move the research forward?
And that's, you'd want more lines because of the genetic diversity that they would represent.
Yes, that's one very good reason for having them. And lines, just like individuals, are very idiosyncratic. So one line may do very well for a while and then simply not do well. Another line may have a very different kind of genetic signature to it. One line might be of a certain variety of cell. It actually may make a certain kind of cell better than another. This is all very, very early yet, and many of the procedures simply haven't been standardized. So science really moves by kind of big groups of collaborative scientists all working together on problems simultaneously, and 12 to 20 lines simply just doesn't cut it for that kind of strategy.
What has been the actual impact of the federal funding ban on new stem cell lines? What's the impact of this policy on actual research in the U.S.?
Well, it's still early. The 2001 proclamation now will reach its fifth year. I can tell you some anecdotal things that I've noticed. We're losing scientists to other countries, embryonic stem cell scientists. When I was at the University of California, San Francisco, I lost one of my top stem cell scientists, Roger Peterson, to the United Kingdom. He just went to Cambridge because he can do that research there, the Great Britain and other UK countries can actually encourage and permit embryonic stem cell research. And I think the thing that worries me most are young investigators. These are students, PhD students, scientists who have all of their careers wanted to be a cell biologist. And this represents probably the richest area of cell biology that we've ever seen. And so these young scientists are looking at the possibility of not having any money. Number one, not having any money for their research. And number two, we could talk about this a little bit later, there's legislation now pending in Congress that would put them in jail if they did this research. So if I were a young man or woman and I was starting my lab for the first time and I knew that I had to start that research using government funds, I would probably pick a different career. And so this is kind of the unseen damage by our current policy. These young scientists and old scientists alike, older, more mature scientists, are simply drying on the vine. And as a result, American competitiveness may be lagging behind other countries that are going at this full speed.
I've also heard that the federal funding ban complicates research in labs and facilities that were built or equipped with federal money, that you can't use the actual equipment.
Yes, that's a very good point. I'll give you a couple of examples of how this plays out. In one laboratory that I know in the Midwest, it's a brand new facility, 20,000 square feet, gleaming new pieces of equipment, all bought with government money, but the person who runs this stem cell center has painted a line down the center of his laboratory. And on one side of that line are the experiments that can go on using government money, the so-called legal experiments. And on the other side of that line are experiments that can only be conducted using private funds. And the reason he's got the line on the floor is because if some very tired graduate student who's working late at night, and they do, they work into the wee hours of the morning, actually takes a culture of stem cells from one side and puts it into, let's say, a piece of equipment that was bought with private money in the other, that student could be breaking the law. We just don't know. And this is just a very unusual and, frankly, bizarre feature of our policy. I've been in life sciences for 25 years. It's a very open and collaborative environment. Indeed, it's what makes America the top dog in biomedical and biotechnological research. And So this kind of artificial barrier really hinders our ability to be able to communicate and collaborate. Another example is the following. Let's say a postdoctoral fellow, someone who's training to become a faculty, is publishing some research on a non-approved government line, a line that was supported by a company, let's say. And she is sitting at her computer, and she's going to send the electronic manuscript to a journal. Let's say that computer was bought with government money. The question then becomes, is she breaking the law? And although these sound like little picayune kind of strange questions, they really keep a lot of people up at night, and they're really unfortunate side effects of this backwards sort of look at how we should conduct research in the United States.
We have a call to talk with. Let's do that. Let me mention again our guest this hour, Focus 580, Christopher Thomas Scott. He directs the Stanford Program in Stem Cells and Society. He's also author of the book Stem Cell Now, From the Experiment That Shook the World to the New Politics of Life, published by Pi Press. Phone numbers around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Champaign County, line number one. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very suspicious of, GM foods and corporate manipulation of the germs of genetic information, basically. But I'm very supportive of this. Now, maybe some people see that as contradictory, but I think I can make the connection between the non-government funding of stem cell research, putting a lot of it into the corporate funding sphere, which is already a problem in academia as far as sharing of research, et cetera, that it actually makes a more dangerous situation for eventual use, that there won't be as much peer review, scrutiny, et cetera, that we supposedly pride our academics in, which, you know, is warranted, but I think this is contributing to our already chronic problem in academia. That's a big topic, but another sort of more minute thing in this is that it seems to me that I haven't really heard people making the argument that if the research goes ahead, it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, using stem cells, creating, you know, embryos a lot. And I'm not saying this may be a false hope, and I support the research even if this doesn't come about, but by knowing the way these things are controlled, there might be a way to make the body's own stem cells do the repair. So, but you need to do one needs to do the research to get to the point to find out if that's plausible or not. I'll listen.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks for the call.
But those are two very good points. The first point about the caller's description of this as being a dangerous situation where no government research means that the basic research, the elemental questions are actually being asked in companies first. And I'll elaborate on his point a little bit, and that's that biotechnology companies, by definition, must be very protective of their discoveries and their intellectual property. So that means that they have to hold that information tightly and not share it with others. And the argument goes that if there is no government funding that would put the answers to these questions in the public domain through the university or institute system, that where all that billion, where all those billions of dollars go, then that information is really either, number one, delayed or perhaps lost. I mean, you could even imagine a biotech company trying to struggle to bring a technology to market and simply failing, and so all of that knowledge kind of fails or disappears with it. So that's a valid concern, and I think that what gets lost in that question, however, is that without a big basket of basic knowledge that comes out of the university and institute system, there will be no companies. So it works this way. A young scientist or a scientist in an academic medical center gets money from the National Institutes of Health. They pursue an interesting question in stem cell biology and then have a eureka moment where they actually create a line of stem cells that could be therapeutically useful. Well, what the university will do at that stage is apply for a patent for that technology, because the government gives universities rights to do that, mm-hmm. in fact encourages them. Then those patents are then taken up and licensed by biotech companies and pharmaceutical companies to develop into products, and those products eventually make it into human use. So the problem, as I see it, from the lack of funding is that the intellectual property, the discoveries never happen. And if you don't have those discoveries that actually form the basis of new companies, then you are putting yourself at a tremendous competitive and economic disadvantage. The second point is also important, and the caller points out an important twist to stem cell research, and he's right. There has to be the research done on the front end to figure out how stem cells behave. Scientists call it stemness. You know, what makes a stem cell? There are a lot of really interesting questions about that. But if you can answer those questions, you may be able to devise, let's say, a pill or a type of a chemical that you could give to a person that would actually stimulate natural stem cell production in a particular organ mm-hmm. or body. So it's a very interesting area to think about, really, how not so much just transplanting stem cells, but getting your own stem cells to work better.
We have a couple callers to talk with. Let's go on next to a Champagne listener, line number 2. Good morning.
Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very interesting program. Thank you. You mentioned earlier that we start out as one cell and then become, I think I heard, billions and trillions. But could you roughly say how many, that must be cells total rather than kinds of cells, or is it kinds of cells?
Hmm. Trillions is the sum total. Of the kinds of cells, we're still not sure how many different kinds, but the rough ballpark is in the hundreds.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to count my organs, but you saved me a little trouble. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks so much. We have just about 10 minutes left, and the caller waiting, so let's talk with them. Someone in Chicago, line number 4. Good morning.
Oh, yes. My comment is I think a lot of this embryonic stem cell research is a scam. It's a ripoff of the taxpayers. In a sense, where they're actually doing it, because I remember back in the 1990s, biotech firms were selling their stocks at high prices because of the so-called great hope in this type of research, and they ripped off the investors at that time. You remember companies like mClone, that was what Martha Stewart was involved with, and then the stock prices dropped when they figured out that there was great problems with this type of thing. And now I think they're trying to rip off taxpayers, because I know that the biotech firms are heavy contributors to certain politicians, and they donate heavily to universities. And I think it's really political, and I think the money should be going into things which are proven. When you have scarce resources, there's proven results with adult stem cells and with, as you said before, umbilical cords. And to put it into embryonic, like some states are doing, I think is just ripping off the taxpayers.
Well, I disagree with the caller's assertion that this is a ripoff of taxpayers. The entire biomedical enterprise really is driven by what I've just described, how inventions actually move from universities into companies. Without that process, we would simply not have most of the drugs, devices, and other things that we use today to our own benefit, to our health benefit. I think that the caller has an interesting point about scarce resources, and in fact, at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics, where I work, we do think hard about actually putting billions of dollars into stem cell research versus putting those billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars, perhaps in California, it's the case that a bond measure, once it finds itself free of legal problems, would actually fund embryonic stem cell research and adult stem cell research at up to $300 million a year. And the question is this the best use of scarce resources for medical research? I think an argument actually can be made that we should be using some of our taxpayer dollars to be chasing problems that are perhaps a little bit closer to being solved. Cancer research might be one of them. Other sorts of diseases that we know a little bit more about might be another. The flip side of that argument, however, is America has always been very, very strong and forward-thinking about new therapies. It's why we're the best at this. And so there is, at least in my view, a distinct future advantage that may be foregone if you don't attack this quickly and with a lot of money. You'll never know what you leave behind if you leave stem cell and regenerative medicine behind. You'll never know what kind of therapies will come out of this. And really, among the biological disciplines, this is a fascinating and very fast-moving field. So my view is, at least at this stage, that we should be pressing fully ahead with this, and to do it in a way, possibly the best that we can, that will return the therapies by way of investment back to society.
We have just about 3 or 4 minutes left. I wanted to at least briefly touch on the controversy in South Korea with the work of Dr. Woo Suk Wang. Could you sort of review the controversy surrounding this research and maybe talk about how this has affected the science community and support for stem cell research?
Sure. Wang Musuk in 2004 announced a thunderous result in the scientific journal Science. He said then that he had made the first therapeutic line, line of human embryonic stem cells using nuclear transfer, that technique I described mm-hmm. at the top of the program. And it was an amazing announcement because it, for the first time, showed that the technique that could be used in animals using the same technique that cloned Dolly could actually be used to develop a line of human embryonic stem cells. So that was the first result, and it really set science on its ear. It was a big, big result. Then, in 9 months, he announced a second groundbreaking result, saying that he had improved the procedure substantially by an order of magnitude or more, and he had also created the first, what he called, patient-specific line. So these would be the lines, stem cell lines, that would be made for a certain patient's use, a patient with a specific disease like diabetes or Alzheimer's or something like that. And this was also a groundbreaking result. And so the scientific community, of course, was ecstatic. The patient and caregiver committee societies were also very, very encouraged by these results. And the upshot to bring the story to a crashing halt was that his lab, Dr. Wang's lab, had fabricated the results not only in 2005, but he had lied about the results in 2004. And in fact, the lines that he claimed to didn't exist at all, and in fact were just lines of embryonic stem cells made from embryos which had been around and discovered very early on in the late 1990s, and that the patient-specific line simply didn't exist. That was the fraud part of the debacle. There was also another very troubling ethical issue that arose from his studies, and that's that he used eggs, human eggs, from his own laboratory associates and assistants that worked in South Korea. And that raised the very troubling question of whether those eggs were donated willingly and with full autonomy by the women involved, or whether those eggs were actually coerced, donated by coercion. And there was a clear conflict of interest in any case, in my view, for having those eggs as part of the experiments. And he also lied about that. The last bit of information about the trial is that he claimed to only use 100 or a couple hundred eggs to actually make the lines in question. I think 400 eggs in total over the course of the two experiments. But on a further investigation, the South Korean government revealed that he had actually used over 2,000 eggs. It was a stunning revelation. So from an ethical point of view, both from research ethics and from medical ethics and stem cell ethics, it's a really good case study about how to do everything wrong. And it will go into history as probably one of the worst abuses of science that we know on. As to the question of whether or not this has set back embryonic stem cell research, my answer to that is no. Embryonic stem cell research scientists have been working diligently since the report in 2004 and 2005 from the Wang lab. They will continue to do so now. This is a great, thriving community of science, and I think that his techniques would have been tested and tried in any case, whether he lied about them or not, such as the way that science moves. Once you publish a result, the first thing that scientists do is look at it kind of with one eye closed and say, I'm not so sure about that. I'm going to test to see if, number one, it actually works, and number two, I can improve it. So the end result would have been he would have been found out anyway, I think.
Well, we're going to have to stop there since we're out of time, but I will suggest for folks, if you'd like to learn more on this topic, the book Stem Cell Now, From the Experiment That Shook the World to the New Politics of Life, published by Pi Press, that's P-I Press, and the author is our guest, Christopher Thomas Scott. And Dr. Scott, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Jack.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union.
That's it for this hour, Focus 580, actually Focus for the week. Time to hand things off to Jason Croft, hosting today's Afternoon Magazine.
Thanks, Jack.